All the stuff I had in New York was in boxes on the sidewalk outside the West 10th Street apartment, and the locks had already been changed. My visa status was linked to my employer. I had 30 days to leave the country. Where to stay took longer. I'd never really paid for anything in New York. I lived on Amy, ate with Amy, went out with Amy. And the news my phone brought me of the price of a single night in a Manhattan hotel made me feel like Rip Van Winkle waking from his 100-year sleep. Sitting on the front steps of West 10th, I tried to think of alternatives, friends, acquaintances, connections. All links were weak and led anyway back to Amy. I considered an impossibility. Walking in an easterly direction down this street till it met, in some sentimental dream, the west end of Sidmouth Road, where my mother would answer the door and lead me to her spare box room, half buried in books. Where else? Where next? I had no coordinates. Unhailed cabs went by, one after the other, and fancy ladies with their little dogs. This being Manhattan, nobody paused to watch what must have looked like a staged reenactment. A weeping woman sat on a step under that Lazarus plaque, huddled by boxes far from home. I remembered James and Daryl. I'd met them both back sometime in March. It was on a Sunday night, my night off. I'd travelled uptown alone to see the Alvin Ailey dancers, and in the theatre got talking to my seatmates, two gentlemen New Yorkers in their late 50s, a couple, one white and one black. James was English, tall and bald, with a lugubrious voice and a very jolly laugh, still dressed for a pleasant pub lunch in some Oxfordshire hamlet, though he had lived here many years. And Daryl was American, with a grey-tipped afro, molish eyes behind glasses, and trousers with frayed hems and paint splattered on them, like a student artist. He knew so much about what was happening on stage, the history of each piece, of New York ballet in general, and Alvin Ailey in particular, that at first I thought he must be a choreographer or an ex-dancer himself. In fact, they were both writers, funny and full of insight. I enjoyed their whispered opinions concerning the uses and limits of cultural nationalism in dance, and I, who had no opinions about dance, only wonderment, amused them, too, clapping after every light change and leaping to my feet as soon as the curtain fell.
It's nice to see revelations with someone who hasn't seen it 50 times, noted Daryl.
And afterwards they invited me for a drink in the hotel bar next door, and told a long and dramatic story of a house they'd bought in Harlem, an Edith Wharton-era wreck, which they were doing up with their life savings, hence the paint. To me, it was an obviously heroic effort, but one of their neighbours, a woman in her 80s, disapproved. Both of James and Daryl, and the fast-paced gentrification of the neighborhood. She liked to shout at them in the street and push religious materials through the letterbox. James did an excellent physical impression of this lady, and I laughed too much and finished a second martini. It was such a relief to be out with people who did not care about Amy and did not want anything from me.
"And one afternoon," said Daryl, "I was walking alone, James was somewhere else, and she leaps out of the shadows, grabs my arm, and says, 'But I can help you get away from him. You don't need a master. You can be free. Let me help you.' She could have been going door to door, stumping for Barack, but no, her thing was James enslaving me. She was offering me my own personal underground railway. Smuggle me up into Spanish Harlem."
I had seen them occasionally since, on my free Sunday nights in the city. I watched them chip away at plaster to reveal original cornices and fake porphyry by flicking specks of paint at a dark pink wall. Each time I visited, I was moved. How happy they were together after so many years. I didn't have many other models of that idea. Two people creating the time of their own lives, protected somehow by love, not ignorant of history but not deformed by it, either. I liked them both so much, though I couldn't really call them more than acquaintances. But I thought of them now. And when I sent a cautious text from the steps of West 10th, the response was immediate, characteristically generous. By dinner time, I was at their table, eating better food than I'd ever come close to at Amy's. Flavoursome, fat-filled, pan-fried food. A bed had been made for me in one of the several spare rooms, and I found they were like fondly prejudiced parents. However I told my tale of woe, they refused to consider any part of it my fault. In their view, I should be the angry one. All the blame was Amy's, none of it was mine. And I went to my beautiful, wood-panelled room, comforted by this rose-tinted vision. I wasn't angry until Judy sent the non-disclosure contract over the next morning. I looked at a PDF of a piece of paper I must have signed, age 23, though I couldn't remember ever doing so. Within its inflexible terms, the things that came out of my mouth did not belong to me any longer, not my ideas or opinions or feelings, not even my memories. They were all hers. Everything that had happened in my life in the past decade belonged to her. Rage rose up in me instantaneously. I wanted to burn her house down. But everything you need to burn somebody's house down these days is already in your hand. It was all in my hand. I didn't even need to get out of bed. I set up an anonymous account, chose the gossip site she hated most, wrote an email containing everything I knew about little Sankofa, attached the photo of her adoption certificate, pressed send. Satisfied, I went down to breakfast, expecting, I suppose, my hero's welcome. But when I told my friends what I'd done and what I thought it meant, James's face turned as grave as the medieval St. Morris statue in the hall, and Darrell took off his glasses, sat down and blinked at the pinewood dining table. He told me he hoped I understood how much, in a short time, he and James had come to love me. It was because they loved me they could tell me the truth, and that the only thing my email signified was that I was still very young. 10. They camped outside Amy's brownstone. 2 days later, to my shame, they were knocking on James and Darrell's door. But that part was Judy's doing. A blind item. Illicit affair, vengeful ex-employee. Judy came from a different era, when blind items stayed blind and you could control the story. They had my name within a few hours and soon after my location. God knows how. Maybe Tracy is right. Maybe we are tracked at all times through our phones. I stayed in bed while James brought up cups of tea and opened and shut the door to a persistent reporter, and Darrell and I watched the tide turn on my laptop in real time as the day went on. Without doing anything different, without taking any action at all, I went from Judy's tawdry, jealous minion to the people's bold whistleblower, all in a few hours. Refresh, refresh. Addictive. My mother called, and before I could even ask her how she was, she said,
"Alan showed me on the computer, and I think it was a really brave act. No, you've always been a bit cowardly. I don't mean cowardly. A bit timid. It's my fault. I over protected you. Probably mollycoddled you. This is the first really brave thing I've seen you do, and I'm very proud."
Who was Alan? Her speech sounded slurry and not quite her own, more fake posh than I'd ever heard it. I asked in a light way about her health. She gave nothing away. She'd had a little cold, but it had passed. And though I knew for a fact she was lying to me, she sounded so adamant it felt like the truth. I promised her I'd come to visit her the moment I was back in England, and she said,
"Yes. Yes, of course you will,"
with far less conviction than she'd said everything else. My next call was from Judy. She asked me if I wanted to get out. She already had a ticket for me, on the red-eye, tonight. At the other end there would be an apartment I could use for a few nights, near Lord's Cricket Ground, until the fuss died down. I tried to thank her. She laughed her seal bark.
You think I'm doing this for you? What the fuck is wrong with you?
Okay, Judy, I already said I'll take the ticket.
That's gracious of you, love, after the mountain of shit you've created for me.
What about Lamin?
What about Lamin?
He expected to come to England. You can't just...
You're ridiculous.
The phone went dead. After the sun went down and the last man on the doorstep left, I abandoned my boxes with James and Darrell and got a taxi on Lennox. The driver was of that deepest shade, like Hauer, and had a likely-sounding name, and I was in the state of seeing signs and symbols everywhere. I leant forward with my year-off enthusiasms and rag-bag of local facts and asked him where he was from. He was Senegalese, but this didn't hamper me much. I spoke without pause through the Midtown Tunnel and out into Jamaica. He beat the steering wheel every now and then with the hub of his right hand and sighed and laughed.
So, you know how it is back home, that village life. It's not easy, but that's the life I miss. But, sister, you should have come to see us. You could have just walked down the road.
Actually, the friend I was telling you about, I said, looking up for a moment from my screen. From Senegal? We just organized to meet in London. I was just messaging him. I repressed the urge to tell this stranger that I, in my generosity, had paid for Lamin's ticket.
Oh, nice, nice. London is better? More nice than here?
Different.
28 years I've been here. Here is so stressful. You have to be so angry to survive here. You live off the anger. It's too much.
We were pulling into JFK, and when I tried to give him his tip, he returned it.
Thank you for coming to my country, he said,
forgetting I hadn't. 11. Now everyone knows who you really are. By the time I landed, our old girlhood dance was out in the world. I find it interesting that Tracy chose not to send it to me until 2 whole days later. In her vision of things, others would know who I really was before I did, but then perhaps they always do. It reminded me of her way with our earliest tales of ballet dancers in peril, how she would correct and edit me.
No, that part here. It'd go better if she died on page 2.
Moving and rearranging things to create the greatest impact. Now she had achieved the same effect with my life, placing the beginning of the story at an earlier point so that all that came after read as the twisted consequence of a lifelong obsession. It was more convincing than my version. It drew the strangest reactions from people. Everybody wanted to see the footage, and nobody did. It was pulled down wherever it was posted almost as soon as it went up. For some, maybe you, it was borderline child pornography, if not in intention, then in effect. Others found it only exploitative, though it is hard to put your finger on who is exploiting whom. Can children exploit themselves? Is it anything more than a couple of girls messing around, simply 2 girls dancing, 2 brown girls dancing like adults, copying adult moves innocently but skillfully, as brown girls often can? And if you think it more than that, then who has the problem, exactly, the girls in the film or you? Whatever is said or thought about it seems to make the viewer complicit. The best thing is not to see it at all. That is the only possible high ground. Otherwise, this cloud of guilt, which can't be exactly placed, but still you feel it. Even I, watching the video, had the troubling thought, well, if a girl behaves like that at the age of 10, can she ever be said to be innocent? What won't she do at 15, at 22, at 33? The desire to be on the side of innocence is so strong. It pulsated out of my phone in waves and all those posts and rants and commentaries. By contrast, the baby was innocent, the baby was guilt-free. Amy loved the baby. The child's birth parents loved Amy. They wanted her to raise their baby. Judy got that message out far and wide. Who was anyone to judge? Who was I?
Now everybody knows who you really are. The tide turned again, fiercely and with great sympathy in Amy's direction. But there were still people on the doorstep of Judy's rental, despite all her preparations and the doorman's promises, and on the third day I left with Lamin for my mother's Sidmouth Road flat, which I knew, in all available records, would be registered in Miriam's name. There was no one on the doorstep. When I rang the doorbell, there was no answer, and my mother's phone went to voicemail. Finally, a neighbor let us in. She looked confused, shocked, when I asked where my mother was. This woman, too, would now know who I really was. The kind of daughter who had not yet heard her own mother was in a hospice. It looked like all the spaces my mother had ever lived in. Books and papers everywhere, just as I remembered, but more so. The space for actual living had been reduced. Chairs were serving as bookshelves, and all available tables, most of the floor, the work surfaces in the kitchen. It wasn't chaos, though. There was a logic to it. In the kitchen, diaspora fiction and poetry dominated, and the bathroom was mostly histories of the Caribbean. There was a wall of slave narratives and commentaries upon them, leading from her bedroom down the hall to the boiler. I found the address of the hospice on the fridge. It was written in somebody else's handwriting. I felt sad and guilty. Who did she ask to write it? Who drove her there? I tried to do a little tidying. Lamin lent a hand, half-heartedly. He was used to women doing for him, and soon sat himself down on my mother's sofa to watch the same heavy old TV set from my childhood, kept half-hidden behind an armchair, to make the point that it was never watched. I moved piles of books back and forth, making little headway, and after a while gave up. I sat at my mother's table, with my back to Lamin, opened my laptop, and returned to what I'd spent the whole of yesterday doing, searching for myself, reading of myself, and seeking Tracy, too, below the line. She wasn't hard to find. Generally, the fourth or fifth comment, and she always went at it full tilt, every time. No compromise, aggressive, full of conspiracy. She had many aliases. Some were quite subtle. Tiny references to moments from our shared history, songs we'd liked, toys we'd had, or numeral recombinations of the year we first met or our dates of birth. I noticed she liked to use the words sordid and shameful, and the phrase, where were their mothers? Whenever I saw that line or a variation upon it, I knew it was her. I found her everywhere, in the most unlikely places. In other people's feeds, under newspaper articles, on Facebook walls, abusing anyone who did not agree with her arguments. As I followed her trail, the idiotic daytime shows came and went behind me. If I turned to check on Lamin, I found him still as a statue, watching. Turn that down a little? He'd increased the volume suddenly on a property makeover show, of the kind my father had once liked to watch. The man is speaking about Edgware. I have an uncle in Edgware, and a cousin. Do you? I said, trying not to sound too hopeful. I waited, but he returned to his show. The sun went down. My stomach began to rumble. I didn't move from my seat. I was too intent on my Tracy hunt, flushing her out of the covert and checking a secondary window every 15 minutes or so to see if she'd invaded my inbox. But her methods with me were apparently different than with my mother. That one-line email was all she ever sent me. At 6, the news came on. Lamin was very affected by the revelation that the people of Iceland were suddenly catastrophically poor. How could such a thing happen? A failed harvest? A corrupt president? But it was news to me, too, and not understanding all of what the newsreader said, I could offer no interpretation. Maybe we will hear information also of Sankofa, Lamin suggested, and I laughed, stood up, and told him they didn't put that kind of nonsense on the evening news. 20 minutes later, as I peered into the fridge full of rotting produce, Lamin called me to come back in. It was the closing story on the real news. the British Broadcast News, as he called it, and there in the top right corner was a stock photo of Amy. We sat on the edge of the sofa, cut to a strip-lit office space somewhere, with a picture of the frog-faced President for Life askew on the wall, in front of which the birth parents sat in their country clothes, looking hot and uncomfortable. A woman from an adoption agency sat to their left and translated. I tried to remember if the mother was the same person I'd seen that day in the corrugated iron hut, but couldn't be sure. I listened to the agency woman explain the situation to the foreign correspondent who sat opposite them all. He was wearing a version of my old wrinkled uniform of linen and khaki. Everything had been done according to procedure. What had been leaked was not the adoption certificate at all. It was only an intermediary document, clearly not intended for public consumption. The parents were satisfied with the adoption and understood what they had signed. We have no problem, said the mother, in halting English, smiling at the camera. Lamin put both hands behind his head and sank back into the sofa and offered me a proverb. Money makes problems go away. I switched it off. Silence spread through the house. We had nothing whatsoever to say to each other. The third point on our triangle was gone. 2 days ago, I had been pleased with my dramatic gesture, fulfilling a duty of care Amy had neglected, but the gesture itself had obscured the reality of Lamin. Lamin in my bed, Lamin in this living room, Lamin indefinitely in my life. He had no job and no money. None of his hard-won qualifications meant anything here. Each time I left the room to get tea to go to the toilet, my first thought upon seeing him again was, what are you doing in my house? At 8 o'clock I ordered Ethiopian takeaway. As we ate, I showed him Google Maps and where we were in London in relation to the rest of the city. I showed him Edgware, the various ways you can get to Edgware. I'll be going to see my mother tomorrow, but feel free to hang around here, obviously. Or, you know, go off exploring. Anyone watching us that evening would have thought we had met a few hours earlier. I felt shy of him once more, of his proud self-containment and capacity for silence. He was not Amy's Lamin anymore, but he wasn't mine either. I had no idea who he was. When it was clear I'd run out of geographical conversation, he stood up and, without any discussion, went to the box room. I went to my mother's room. We closed our doors. The hospice was in Hampstead, on a quiet tree-lined cul-de-sac, a stone's throw from the hospital where I was born, and a few streets from the noted activist. Autumn was pretty here, russet and gold against all that valuable red-brick Victorian real estate, and I had strong associative memories of my mother walking through it on brisk mornings like this one, arm in arm with the noted activist, bemoaning the Italian aristocrats and American bankers, the Russian oligarchs and the upscale children's clothes stores, the basements being dug out of the earth. The end of some long-lost bohemian idea of the place she'd held dear. She was 47 then. She was only 57 now. Of all the futures I had imagined for her in these streets, somehow the present reality seemed the most improbable. When I was a child, she had been immortal. I couldn't imagine her leaving this world without ripping its fabric. Instead, this quiet street, these ginkgo trees shedding their golden leaves. At the desk, I gave my name, and after a short wait, a young male nurse came for me. He warned me that my mother was on morphine and sometimes confused before leading me to her room. I didn't notice anything about this nurse. He seemed completely nondescript. But when I got to the room, and he opened the door, my mother pushed herself up in her bed and cried,
Alan Pennington, so you've met the famous Alan Pennington.
Mum, it's me.
Oh, I'm Alan,
said the nurse, and I turned round to look again at this young man my mother was smiling at so radiantly. He was short, with sandy brown hair, small blue eyes, a slightly pudgy face,
and an unremarkable nose with a few freckles over the bridge. The only thing that made him unusual to me in the context of all the Nigerian, Polish, and Pakistani nurses you heard talking in the corridors was how English he looked.
"Alan Pennington is famous around here," said my mother, waving at him. "His kindness is legend."
Alan Pennington smiled at me, revealing a pair of pointy incisors like a little dog's.
"I'll leave you two alone," he said.
"How are you, Mum? Are you in a lot of pain?"
"Alan Pennington,"
she informed me, after the door had closed behind him,
"only works for others.
Did you know that?
You hear about these people, but it's another thing to meet them. Of course, I've worked for others all my life, but not like this. They're all like that here. I had a girl from Angola first, Fatima, lovely girl. She was the same. Unfortunately, she had to move on. Then Alan Pennington came. You see, he is a carer. I never thought about that word very deeply before. Alan Pennington cares."
"Mum, why do you keep calling him Alan Pennington like that?" My mother looked at me like I was an idiot.
"Because that's his name. Alan Pennington is a carer who cares."
"Yes, Mum, that's what carers are paid to do."
"No, no, no. You don't understand. He cares. The things he does for me? No one should have to do those things for another human being. But he does them for me."
Tiring of the subject of Alan Pennington, I convinced her to let me read aloud for a while from a slim book she had on her side table, a little standalone edition of Sonny's Blues, and then lunch arrived on the tray of Alan Pennington.
"But I can't eat that," said my mother sadly as Alan lay it across her lap.
"Well, how about I leave it with you for 20 minutes, and if you're absolutely sure you can't eat it, just ring the bell and I'll come and take it back. How would that be? Does that sound all right?"
I waited for my mother to tear a strip of Alan Pennington. All her life she had hated and dreaded being patronized or spoken to like a child. But now she nodded seriously, as if this were a very wise and generous proposal, took Alan's hands in her own shaking, wraith-like grasp and said,
"Thank you, Alan. Please don't forget to come back."
"And forget the most beautiful woman in the place?"
said Alan, though clearly gay, and my mother, lifelong feminist, erupted in girlish giggles. And they stayed like that, holding each other's hands, until Alan smiled and released her, off to care for someone else, abandoning my mother and me to each other. I had a rogue thought. I hated having it. I wished that Amy was here with me. I had been at deathbeds with Amy 4 times, and on each occasion had been impressed and humbled by her way of being with the dying, her honesty, warmth, and simplicity, which nobody else in the room ever seemed able to manage, not even family. Death did not scare her. She looked directly at it, engaged with the dying person in their present situation, no matter how extreme, without nostalgia or false optimism. Accepted your fear when you were afraid, and your pain if you were feeling it. How many people can do these supposedly straightforward things? I remember a friend of hers, a painter who had lost decades to the severe anorexia that eventually killed her, saying to Amy on what turned out to be her deathbed,
"God, Amy, didn't I just waste so much fucking time?"
To which Amy replied, "More than you know." I remember that stick figure between the bedsheets with her gaping mouth, so shocked she burst out laughing. But it was the truth no one else had dared tell her, and dying people, I found out, are impatient for the truth. I spoke no truth whatsoever to my mother. I just made the usual small talk, read her more of her beloved Baldwin, listened to tales of Alan Pennington, and lifted her beaker of juice so she could suck at it through a straw. She knew I knew she was dying, but for whatever reason, bravery, denial, or delusion, she made no reference to it in my presence, except to say, when I asked her where her phone was and why she hadn't answered it, "Look, I don't want to spend the time I have left on that bloody thing." I found it in the compartment of her side table, in a hospital laundry bag, along with a trouser suit, a folder of papers, a guide to parliamentary conduct, and her laptop. "You don't have to use it," I said, powering it up and laying it on the table, "but just leave it on so I have a way of contacting you." The notification alarm started going off. The phone buzzed and danced across the counter, and my mother looked over at it with a kind of horror.
"No, no, no, I don't want it. I don't want it on. Why did you have to do that?"
I picked it up. I could see unopened emails, dozens and dozens of them, filling the screen, abusive even in their subject headings, all from the same address. I started reading through them, trying to resist the catalogue of pain, child support woes, rent arrears, skirmishes with social workers. The most recent were the most frantic. She feared her children were about to be taken from her. "Mum, have you heard from Tracy recently?"
"Where's Alan Pennington? I'm not going to eat this."
"My God, you're so sick right now. You shouldn't have to be dealing with this.
It's not like Alan not to check in.
Mum, have you heard from Tracy?"
"No! Told you I don't look at that thing!"
"You haven't spoken to her?" She sighed heavily.
"I don't have many visitors, darling. Miriam comes. Lambert came once. My fellow members of Parliament do not come. You are here. As Alan Pennington said, you find out who your friends are. I sleep mostly. I dream a lot. I dream of Jamaica. I dream of my grandmother. I got back in time."
She closed her eyes.
"I did have a dream about your friend when I first got here. I was in a high dosage of this."
She tugged at a drip in her arm.
"Yes. Your friend came to visit me. I was asleep and I woke up and she was standing by the door, not talking. Then I went back to sleep and she was gone."
When I got back to the flat, emotionally weak, still jet-lagged, I prayed that Lamon would be out, and he was. When he didn't come back for dinner, I was relieved. Only the next morning, when I knocked on his door, nudged it open, and saw he and his bag were gone, did I realize he'd left. When I called, I got voicemail. I called every few hours for 4 days, and it was the same. I had been so concentrated upon how I might break the news to him that he must leave, that we had no future together, that I hadn't imagined, not for a moment, that all the time he was plotting his own escape from me. Without him, without the TV on, the flat was deadly quiet. It was just me and the computer and the radio, from which more than once I heard the voice of the noted activist, still going strong, full of opinions. But my own story was fading, online and in all other mediums, all that brightly illuminated commentary already burnt out, puttering to blackness and ash. At a loss, I spent a day writing emails to Tracy. First, dignified and righteous, then sarcastic, then angry, then hysterical, until I realized she was having more effect on me with silence than I could manage with all these words. The power she has over me is the same as it has always been. Judgment. And it goes beyond words. There is no case I can make that will change the fact that I was her only witness, the only person who knows all that she has in her, all that's been ignored and wasted, and yet I still left her back there, in the ranks of the unwitnessed, where you have to scream to get heard. Later, I found out Tracy had a long history of sending distressing emails. A director at the Tricycle who had not cast her, she thought because of colour. The teachers at her son's school, a nurse at her doctor's office. But none of this changes the judgment. If she was tormenting my mother as she lay dying, if she was trying to ruin my life, if she was sitting in that claustrophobic little flat, watching my emails line up on her phone and simply choosing not to read them, whatever she was doing, I knew it was a form of judgment upon me. I was her sister. I had a sacred duty towards her. Even if only she and I knew it and recognized it, it was still true. A few times I left the flat for the corner shop to buy cigarettes and packets of pasta, but otherwise I saw no one and heard from no one. At night I picked up random books from my mother's pile, tried to read a little, lost interest, and started another. It occurred to me that I was depressed and needed to speak to another human. I sat with my new pay-as-you-go phone in my hand, looking down at the short list of personal names and numbers I'd copied off the old work phone, summarily disconnected, and tried to imagine what form each interaction would take, if and how I could get through it, but every potential conversation felt like a scene from a stage play, in which I'd be playing that person I'd been for so long, who seems to be at lunch with you but is actually turned towards Amy, working for Amy, thinking of Amy day and night, night and day. I called Fern. The ring was a single long foreign tone, and he answered with, "Hola." He was in Madrid. "Working?"
"Traveling. It will be my year off. Didn't you know I quit? But I'm so happy to be free."
I asked him why, expecting a personal attack directed at Amy, but his answer had no personal aspect. He was concerned with the distorting effect of her money in the village, the collapse of government services in the area, and the foundation's naive, complicit dealings with the government. As he spoke, I was reminded and ashamed of a profound difference between us. I had always been quick to interpret everything personally, where Fern had seen the larger, structural problems. "Well, it's good to hear from you, Fern."
"No, you didn't hear from me. I heard from you."
He left the silence hanging. The longer it went on, the harder it was to think of what to say.
"Why are you calling me?"
I sat listening to him breathe for another few seconds until my phone ran out of credit. About a week later, he emailed to say he was in London for a short trip. I hadn't spoken to anyone but my mother in several days. We met up on the South Bank in the window of the film cafe, sitting side by side, facing the water, and reminisced a little. But it was awkward. I became bitter so easily. Every thought pulled towards darkness, to something painful. All I did was complain, and though I could see I was irritating him, I couldn't seem to stop myself.
"Well, we can say that Amy lives in her bubble," he said, interrupting me. "And so does your friend, and, by the way, so do you. It's possible that it's like this for everyone. The size of the bubble is different, this is all. And perhaps the thickness of the, what do you call this in English? Skin? Film. The thin layer on a bubble."
The waiter came. We paid avid attention to him. When he left, we watched a tourist boat make its way down the Thames.
"Oh, I know what it is I want to tell you," he said suddenly, slapping the bar and rattling a saucer. "I heard from Lamin. He is fine. He is in Birmingham. He wanted a letter of reference from me. He hopes to study. We emailed a little bit. I learned that Lamin is a fatalist. He wrote to me, 'It was intended for me to come to Birmingham, so I was always to come here.' Isn't that funny? No? Well, maybe I used the wrong word in English. I mean that for Lamin, the future is as certain as the past. It is a theory from philosophy."
"Sounds like a nightmare." Fern looked puzzled again.
"Maybe I put it wrong. I am not a philosopher. To me, it means something simple, like to say the future is already there, waiting for you. Why not wait? See what it brings."
His face was so hopeful it made me laugh. We got some of our old friendly rhythm back and sat talking for a long time, and I thought it was not impossible that there might be a future in which I could care for him. I was settling into the idea that I wasn't going anywhere. There was no hurry any longer. I would not be on the next plane. Time was on my side, as much as it is on anyone's. Everything that afternoon felt wide open to me, a kind of shock. I didn't know what was happening in the next few days, or even the next few hours. A new feeling. I was surprised when I looked up from my second coffee and saw the day fading and the night almost upon us. Afterwards, he wanted to get on the tube at Waterloo. It was the best stop for me, too. But instead, I left him and chose the bridge. Ignoring both barriers, walking straight down the centre, over the river, until I reached the other side. Epilogue. The last time I saw my mother alive, we talked about Tracy. That isn't strong enough. Tracy was really the only thing that allowed us to speak at all. My mother was mostly too tired to speak or be spoken to, and for the first time in her life, books held no attraction. I sang to her instead, which she seemed to like, as long as I stuck to the old Motown classics. We watched TV together, something we'd never done before, and I made small talk with Alan Pennington, who came in every now and then to check on my mother's fierce hiccups and her stools and the progression of her delusions. He brought lunch, which she could no longer look at, never mind eat. But on that last day we had together, when Alan left the room, she opened her eyes and told me in a calm, authoritative voice, as if remarking on something that was a plain and objective fact, like the weather outside or what was sitting on her plate, that the time had come to do something about Tracy's family. At first I thought she was lost in the past. She often was in those last days. But soon I understood she was speaking of the children, Tracy's children, although in speaking of them she moved freely between their reality, as she imagined it, the history of our own little family, and a deeper history. It was the last speech she ever gave. "She works too hard," said my mother, "and the children don't see her, and now they want to take my children away. But your father was very good, very good, and often I think, was I a good mother? Was I? And now they want to take my children away from me. But I was just a student. I am studying, because you have to learn to survive. And I was a mother, and I have to learn, because you knew that any one of us they caught reading or writing faced jail or a whipping or worse, and anyone caught teaching us to read or write got the same, jailed or whipped. It was the law at that time. It was very strict. And in that way we were taken out of our time and place, and then stopped from even knowing our time and place. You can't do anything worse to a people than that. But I don't know if Tracy was a good mother, though I certainly tried my best to raise them all. But I know for sure your father was very good. Very good." I told her she was good. The rest didn't matter. I told her everybody had tried their best within the limits of being themselves. I don't know if she heard me. I was gathering my things when I heard Alan Pennington coming down the hall, singing in his flat, off-tune way, one of my mother's favourite Otis tracks, about being born by the river and running ever since. "Heard you do that one yesterday," he said to me, appearing in the doorway, chipper as ever. "Lovely voice you have. Your mum's very proud of you, you know. She's always talking about you." He smiled at my mother, but she was beyond Alan Pennington. "It's clear as day," she murmured, closing her eyes as I got up to leave. "They should be with you. The best possible place for those children is with you." For the rest of that afternoon, I entertained the fantasy. Not seriously, I don't think. It was only a Technicolor dream song playing in my head. A ready-made family, suddenly in the here and now, filling my life. The next day I took a morning walk around the barren perimeter of Tiverton Wreck, the wind whipping through the caged fence, carrying away sticks thrown wide for dogs, and found myself walking on in the opposite direction from the flat and past the station that would have taken me to the hospice. My mother died at 10:12, just as I turned into Willesden Lane. Tracy's tower came into view, above the horse chestnuts, and with it, reality. These were not my children, would never be my children. I almost turned back, like someone who has woken abruptly from a sleepwalk, except for an idea, new to me, that there might be something else I could offer, something simpler, more honest, between my mother's idea of salvation and nothing at all. Impatient, I left the path and crossed diagonally through the grass, heading for the covered walkway. I was about to enter the stairwell when I heard music, stopped, and looked up. She was right above me, on her balcony in a dressing gown and slippers, her hands in the air, turning, turning, her children around her, everybody dancing. This is Pippa Bennett-Warner. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Swing Time by Zadie Smith. This program was produced and directed by Roy McMillan. Text copyright 2016 by Zadie Smith. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Books Limited. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.